Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So for those who are new here, we have these meetings most Saturdays. Try to do some meditation, and then one of the monks, usually me or a CD, tries to give some reflections on the teaching. And our forest tradition is, its emphasis is on practice of Buddhism rather than just an academic understanding. But there's a certain, in a place like this, there's a certain kind of assumption I always have of people who come here, is that basically we're good people. I think if we were bank robbers, we wouldn't be here. So the kind of underlying assumption is a life lived in with a sense of generosity, a life lived with good ethical principles, a life of responsibility, and so on and so forth. And so I always assume that we're there for that. So I don't tend to give myself hell, fire and brimstone talks about moral issues. I find that a bit boring. Yesterday, Venerable Pumutu and I had a delightful afternoon day out at Big Rideau Lake. I'd never been there. I live close by, and have some friends who have a boat, 21-foot boat, motorboat, docked at Rideau Ferry Harbour. And so we went out. It was a perfect sunny day, and had lunch at Portland. I didn't even know there was a Portland around. So it was a kind of little treat for us, fish and chips. On the way there, it was a perfect day, beautiful day. On the way there, we passed a Rideau Ferry nursing home where my mother stayed 2 years ago. And she stayed there for like, it was only 3 weeks, I think. It wasn't 3 weeks. Only 3 weeks, but it's the kind of worst 3 weeks of my life with her, I think. It was just awful. Just awful. It was so difficult for both of us. And there's a long story around that. It was interesting just kind of going along the road, along Long Lake, and then realizing that's the route I used to take every day to see her. And just the emotional upwelling of that, you know, kind of stomach churning, and then, because it was the same road, and the same road was signaling, this is where my mother was, this is where I suffered, this is where she suffered. So the memory is very, very unpleasant, very unpleasant. And then we drove by, and yet no one was unkind to us. It was a kind, it was just one of, you know, life's difficult sufferings. And then we went on, the memory went, got on the boat and felt fine. I've got a one exhibit A. If you can see this far, you see one thumb is shorter than the other. You can't see it. I put this thumb through a table saw in New Zealand. I don't advise it. It's stiff. I had to pin it together. It doesn't work well. It gets really cold in the winter. Overly sensitive, etc. When I put this through the table saw, they monastery drove me. I think we wrapped it in frozen peas. I guess it was, or frozen corn. I'm not sure which. I think it was just blood all over the place. So we went to, this is in New Zealand with Ajahn Kuslo, and we drove to Lower Hutt Hospital, and they took me to the hospital, and they asked me, "What are you?" I said, "I'm a monk." They said, "Okay." And so they just got someone just to stitch it up. If I would have said I'm a pianist, they would have got a really good surgeon, and maybe it would work. Anyway, if ever that happens, say you're a pianist. What's all this got to do with anything? The surgeon, when they looked, I was under a local anesthesia, one of those in the neck, arm block, and they kind of, the surgeon opens up. She said, "What a mess! Thanks a lot." Anyway, they kind of stitched me up. As they were stitching me up, they're talking about actually fish and chips, what they're going to have for lunch. It's surreal. So there was the steel pin sticking out of my thumb. So the doctor said I had to come back in a few weeks' time and get the pin out. So all the monks and the laymen and that we were building a meditation hall. We kept joking with me, "Very dumb. They're just going to pull it out with a pair of pliers," and they showed me a pair of pliers. So this is about memory. I'm on track. I really am on track. Don't worry. Same thing actually. So I got to go back to the hospital now. Same hospital and get this piece of iron, which is. Allowed my bones to grow together. I got to get that pulled out. So it's the same road, the same car, and the same panic. Not panic, what is that? Like shock, huh? Kind of shock. And just, and in my rational mind, I could say, well, it doesn't matter, you know. But the memory of the shock to the body was so powerful that same feel, not as intense, obviously, but very surprisingly intense. Just came through my body in a horrible drive. And I go into the office, and you know, the guy had the same kind of pliers, the doctor. He just pulled this thing out, it didn't hurt. But this is not about my thumb or about my mouth, it's about memory. And I think it's very important to reflect that we as human beings, we are memory is a very important part of our lives, and it's a very powerful part of our lives. And to be able to see memory is very, very helpful, rather than to be, say, preoccupied with unskillful memories or painful memories, but not to deny them, not to push them away. So, say, with, like yesterday, driving by the nursing home, because I just knew it's just memory, and I stayed with my body. I didn't go off into the narratives. And this is very important in a contemplative life, to learn how not just to run with the thinking, not just to always take any kind of impulse or feeling or memory or whatever, and just run it with it with thought. Because then we are always victims to these life circumstances. Life is painful enough, but then we kind of compound the problem by making it more painful. Yeah, so you know, driving by the nursing home, said, "Wow, look at this! This is interesting." It was unpleasant, not nice, but it was also interesting. Look how powerful memory is, and that sense of witnessing the movement of consciousness, rather than always being the subject of these conscious changes, is a tremendous freedom, isn't it? You know, the fact that I can witness and observe the way consciousness works. Because it's not just about this particular memory with my mother, it's just about memory itself. Oh yeah, memory works that way. And that, I think that's what the Buddhist teaching is trying to encourage us to do, is to understand what it means to be human, to have an emotional body, to have memory, to have a physical body, and so on and so forth. So memory can be very, very... can be very intense, can be very vague, it can be very selective, remember different things. So say when my mother died, it was like a tsunami of feelings, because I was with her when she died, and I had been with her for a long time. So you know, that's the power, the impact on consciousness is just so very, very powerful. So then the aftermath of those memories are like visceral, almost like you're there, they're so close. And that's just the nature of it. It's just the nature of any intense situation. If I'm intensely, like if I get, if someone is betrayed in some way, or if there's a huge loss, or if there's some kind of blissful experience. So the opposite in meditation, people will get maybe very, very blissful meditations, feelings of deep emptiness and silence, and sometimes deep, deep love or light or whatever. And that's also then becomes a memory. And then as it becomes a memory, quite often one tries to manufacture that. It goes the other way, where that was beautiful. I'd like to repeat that. I'd like to manufacture, I'd like to get some more of that, obviously. And then our whole time can be spent in a kind of anticipation, constant anticipation of trying to recreate some kind of memory pattern. The liberation of the heart, I think, from a Buddhist perspective, is to see movement, to see change, and no longer be preoccupied with that which changes. So to kind of unpack that idea. Take a beautiful memory or a painful memory. Take the memory of my mom dying or my mom in the nursing home and the memory of a blissful, meditative, natural experience. Both are memory. Both are constructed. Both begin and end. Both are conditioned by certain factors. Both, as we say in Buddhism, both are born and die. The memory of the experience with my mother is something that came because of causes and conditions. It impacted me, and then it left. And then a memory comes and goes, the same with the beautiful. And so that whole changing nature of consciousness is something that we witness to and that we are a part of. Our consciousness is kind of embedded in all of that. But the liberation of the heart, in Buddhism we'd say you won't find it in the changing nature of consciousness. You'll find it in that which knows change, that which is present, that which is still, that which is aware. And that's something that human beings don't usually pay attention to. They usually pay attention to the bliss or the sorrow, the pain, the happiness, the sweet, the sour, the insults, the praise, the sunny days and the rainy days. So usually our attention is very much caught up in the objective world. And we need to be, you know, we need to make sure the rice doesn't get burnt and that we come on time to a meeting and that we know there's a red light up and we have to stop at the red light and so on. So we need to pay attention to the objective world, no doubt about it. But that's not all there is. That's kind of functional. We have to function in that level, but the Buddha's teaching would say that there is something very, very profound about consciousness. It's profoundly peaceful and profoundly loving if we take some time just to notice how things change rather than always trying to change them. So the kind of worldly consciousness is always trying to change things, rearrange things to make them comfortable, to make them beautiful, to make them somehow fulfilling. And there's nothing wrong with that. We all do that. We all, like I like to hang pictures of my family. There's my family, my monastic family. So I like decor just like anyone else. But if my whole spiritual life was just about decor, it'd be pointless, wouldn't it? Right? So without denying the very natural tendency to try to create beauty and have comfort, the Buddha is saying that to rely on those things, to think that the spiritual liberation lies in things which change, well then you're looking in the wrong place. It's a misguided attitude. And that always comes about when we are disappointed, when there's loss. So with the fish and chips, I thought, oh, it's great fish and chips. Had a stomach ache in the afternoon. Fish and chips are not liberating. So it was nice for a while, and then it changed. And it changed to a long night with an upset stomach. But that which knows that I feel happy with a sense experience and that knows what she knows. I feel painful sense experience. That knowing, that awareness, is what the Buddha said is the gateway to the spiritual life, to the true silence of the mind, to the true liberation of the heart. And so what we try to do in Buddhist practice is try to remember that very sense of knowing this moment. I mean, it's very, very simple, just knowing how you feel. And to begin to learn to abide as that awareness, as that mindfulness, as that knowing. So I suggested in this meditation, learn to just listen. Just learn to listen. And that's an extraordinarily simple idea, but how, if you just think about our consciousness, how much of our time do we spend in preoccupations, where we're just preoccupied with some future event, some sense of self-criticism, some judgment about something, fantasizing about something, regretting something, rehearsing something, you know, kind of back and forth, past and future, but to actually just be fully conscious to this moment, you have to stop thinking. You have to, what we call let go. You have to let go. And what do you let go of? You let go of your preoccupations, the planning, the judging, and so on. Let's say someone who's very, 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 who has a, we all have, let's say, that if you just take like the critical faculty that we all have, the judging faculty, someone who's maybe very, very, sometimes our minds are very, very judgmental. Right? Judgmental of ourselves, judgmental of others, judgmental of our government, of the weather, of the color of the wallpaper, you know, whatever's going on. Now that's just the way the mind might be conditioned and formed. So that might come up. I see something, I notice something. Say like in the chanting sometimes here, in the mornings. Sometimes my mind will be happy because it's in harmony. And sometimes my mind will be critical because it's disharmonious. Sometimes our voices will be fairly good. Oftentimes our voices will be not so great. 5 o'clock in the morning, a bit croaky. Now I can notice that. I can notice the mind which is pleased with the chanting, and I can notice the mind which is displeased with the chanting. Right? And I can let go of both of those. I can also, and I don't do it anymore, but I can also feel the mind which is displeased with the chanting and then give a long talk on chanting and tell everyone, no, you have to chant better and no one's chanting right. And just be so preoccupied with the discordant chanting that I don't realize that my mind is discordant. I don't notice my mind is suffering. I don't notice that I'm caught up in my judgments and aversions and hatreds. And that preoccupation, of course, is a kind of enslavement. A kind of enslavement. And then if I'm really dumb, which I have been in the past, then I get heavy with myself. I get preoccupied with hating myself for hating others. Being judgmental of myself or for being judgmental of others. And it goes on ad nauseum. Right? And that's what we mean by preoccupation, where a simple thing like all of us have a critical faculty, and like in any given day, we're always going to find things to criticize. But if you just logically, if you just start in the morning, think, what's the probability that I'm going to get everything I want today? It's not very high. Pretty low, right? So there's going to be something that doesn't suit me, that doesn't fit my desires. And then when it doesn't fit my desires or my preconceptions or my view of the universe, how it should be, then what will I feel? I feel critical. I'll feel annoyed. I'll feel averse, right? That's just the way it is. Now, I think that's just natural. I mean, that's just the way we are. The question, I think the more interesting thing is, how long do I stay preoccupied with that critical thing that has impacted me? And that to me is kind of very indicative of how free I am. So let's say I'm exaggerating the chanting. I think the chanting's great. but let us say, for example's sake, that you know, we're chanting away, and my voice is the worst right now, so the chanting is disharmonious. And with the arising of disharmonious chanting, there's maybe the arising of a critical mind. Now, if I just notice that, oh, critical mind feels that way, then I'm the witness. And that critical mind, it moves on, it goes into neutrality again. If I'm not mindful, if I'm not awake, if I'm not open and listening to the way things in my inner world, then what do? I take that I take that critical thing and I preoccupy myself with it. It shouldn't be like this, it shouldn't be like that, they shouldn't be like that, they shouldn't be like that, I shouldn't be like this. And we can run that for weeks. We can run it for lifetimes. We're brilliant. And that is both sad for us and sad for others, sad for the universe, right? And that's just preoccupation, that's all it is. There's no ultimate truth in that. It's just habit, conditioned by thought, reconditioned by more aversion, and da 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 da, it goes on and on and on. So the when we talk about the practice of letting go, we're not denying those things. This is the difficulty with this word letting go. We use this a lot in Buddhism. We're not denying these things, but we're just saying we don't have to get reborn into those things. We don't have to spend our lives being preoccupied with that which is negative, unpleasant, and downright suffering. We can let go. And the letting go is not a denial. And the way I kind of been thinking about letting go more and more is I'm using two words a lot these last few years. One is availability, and the other is preoccupation. So if you just take something like in critical faculty, let's say you come into a place and or something about yourself or whatever, and your mind is preoccupied with that, with some self-disparaging bits, some self-criticism, criticism of others, you're not available, are you? You're not available to the way things are because your mind is filled now with negativity. But to become available, what do I need to do? I need to just listen. I just need to know this is the way it is now, and that's letting go. Being available is letting go. And preoccupation is attachment through thought, through habit. So it doesn't deny, like sometimes you think that letting go means that you never feel anything. That's not life. That you're always kind and generous and sensitive and blah, blah, blah. And it's just not life. The life is just this way. You feel negative, you feel positive. But this constant preoccupation with the habits of mind, that's what we're trying to awaken to and not believe in. So that's a kind of, a contemplative. It's a good question to put to yourself is, like, wake up in the morning. It's good to wake up in the morning. When you wake up in the morning, then just like make a note. What kind of mindsets am I preoccupied with? Not as a judgment, just what does my mind actually do? Is it like planning the future? Is it feeling critical about something? Is it anxious? Or is it just open to this moment? Beauty can really open us, can't it? Like a lovely day like this. And it can very open the mind. But a grey day where nothing's happening, quite often our minds just go off in automatic pilot. But just to actually begin to awake to what are the preoccupations of my mind? And are they skillful? You know, are they profitable? Do they lead to my own happiness and happiness of others? Are they productive of joy? Then, of course, you could say, I'm too preoccupied with negativity, I shouldn't be so negative. That's still preoccupation. Because it's still thinking. And that's what we tend to do as meditators, because we're all, most of us are very highly motivated, we're quite altruistic, we have a deep sense of commitment to nonviolence and all that, but we quite often don't know how to let go. We quite often just get into an inner argument. So we find ourselves preoccupied with some negativity, being frightened or anxious or angry or averse or fantasizing this and that. We say, oh, I shouldn't do that. I should stop doing that. Or we analyze it. We're great. Western culture is incredible at analyzing things. We try to get the root of the problem, but we're still thinking. We're not available. So if you use a simple word like just be available, like it's just listen, availability, watchful. You can't think about that. If you start thinking, what does he mean by available? am I being available? He said, you're not available because you're lost in thought. And our culture is a very much analytical culture. We like analysis. We like thought. We like to we like to dwell up in the brain. And one of the many things we try to do in Buddhist meditation is learn how to bring your attention to other parts of your being, like this meditation. Like learn to abide here, learn to live from the heart, right? Like, rather than the default always being into thinking and judgment and analysis, da 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 da. Actually learn to bring your attention down and abide here. Just learn to rest with the heart, rest with the body. And that takes training. If for the past however many years my habit has been always to go to thinking, negative thinking, whatever kind of thinking, and I need to do that sometime. I need to plan and organize and think things through and make sure the accounts are balanced and so on. So there's nothing wrong with thought. But much of thought is just habitual and driven by all kinds of ego things, unskillful habits. So to begin to train the mind and bring it to to let the mind rest in another place rather than just in thought, to allow the mind to rest with the heart or just with your belly, the hara, that takes training. That takes training. And it's a very, very, very gradual training for most. It takes a tremendous amount of patience. But when we start to do that, how do we do that? Well, first of all, we have to awaken. We have to make conscious this present moment. And making conscious the present moment is not a judgment. Judgment is just more being unavailable. But just like listening is not a judgment. And then from that, learning to bring our attention to, the heart's a very good place just to learn to abide with, just learning to rest here. And the mind goes off into thinking and planning and analyzing, and you just learn to bring the mind back to the heart. And when we start to do things like that, when we do a meditation like this, when we learn to awaken to thought and bring it attention to the heart, when we use language like watchful, available, rather than just constantly analyzing ourselves, when we use language like that, we begin to remember presence. And this is another way of thinking about memory. Memory can be narrative memory, and narrative memory can evoke feelings. So memory isn't just in ideas, it's also in the emotions, very, very powerful. But also we can remember, can't we? We can remember skillfully. And that's one of the important aspects of mindfulness training, is that we recollect that which is wholesome and skillful. We remember to abandon that which is unwholesome. So in learning to witness to my own mind, witness to my own inner world, I can bring up ideas. I can recollect ideas which are very balancing, which are very opening, which bring me a sense of presence. So one of the common reflections that is very, very helpful is to say, "Not me, not mine." Not me, not mine. It's a very interesting one. When your mind starts to go off into some kind of negativity or whatever, and you just reflect, "Not me, not mine," you begin to see that's really, I don't really own this. It's just movement. Like that memory of my mother. It's mine. It's not yours. In some in some kind of historical sense, you have a different memory of your mother or whatever, but my involvement with it, getting lost in thought, ego thought, I can get away from that by saying, "Not me, not mine," just memory. Memory feels this way. And that takes me down into the body. When I start to think about my mother and that experience, and I kind of played with that. It was interesting. I played with it a bit. Very painful. I said, "Oh." And I could, I could visualize her in there. And I could think about her difficulties, and I could think about this incident and that incident, and da 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 da. But that is me as an ego being involved in this memory. But when I just bring up a word like "not me, not mine," I don't know about you, but when I do that, and this is practice, when I do that, then I get a sense of, this is just consciousness. Consciousness has memory. Memory has feeling. And it moves through me. It moves through the knowing. It moves through awareness. But that awareness is actually very peaceful. So I found that with that memory, although it was unpleasant, it was also peaceful. Peacefulness isn't either pleasant or unpleasant. Peacefulness is beyond the two. It's a transcendent feeling. Certainly is pleasant in some kind of a sense, but in that sense of an experience, you can be peaceful with the unpleasant. You can be peaceful with the pleasant, because it moves. And that which knows this movement is not moving. You know, awareness is not moving. Awareness is just very still and very open. This is much more subtle than a happy moment or a beautiful moment. It's much more subtle than that. But you can see that the subtlety is in the sense that our pursuit of pleasure and pain is a wrongly directed pursuit. That what we're really pursuing, I think, is that silence of being, that silence of presence. And when we get caught up in our wrong attitudes, then of course we're driven by habits. So the path of awakening always begins in the present moment. This is the way it is now, listening. And it ends with that. You always come back to that. So it's the ultimate in simplicity, but it's our thinking minds that are so complex. Our habits are very, very complex. And so we train. We're kind of constantly training to awaken. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayam dhammakataya sadhukaram dadamase.
Sadhu, sadhu.